Chapter 1. Reciprocity. It was hours before dawn in California when Gavin Newsom's phone rang. The 52-year-old governor was accustomed to early calls from the East Coast, but under normal circumstances, a 4:30 a.m. wake-up call from the White House was unusual. These were anything but normal. The coronavirus pandemic had struck Newsom's state, and the president of the United States wanted to talk about it. Newsom, a Democrat, enjoyed a strange relationship with President Donald Trump. The two had known each other since long before Trump's election in 2016. When he was merely a celebrity real estate developer, Trump had donated money to one of Newsom's campaigns, and Newsom's ex-wife, the television personality Kimberly Guilfoyle, was dating the president's eldest son. Trump and Newsom had dealt with each other in office a number of times, mainly around natural disasters like wildfires. They had a disaster on their hands now. It was the very beginning of March, and the respiratory pathogen that had already ravaged parts of China and Italy was in increasingly abundant evidence in the United States. The first case had been confirmed on January 21st in Washington State, and 6 weeks later, West Coast governors and mayors were moving toward embracing strict clampdowns on public activity and commerce in order to slow the spread of the disease. Trump had something more specific on his mind. The president was concerned about the Grand Princess, a cruise ship anchored off San Francisco. Passengers on the ship had been exposed to the coronavirus, and it was not yet clear what the local, state, or federal government would do with the people on board. "If we bring them ashore," Trump complained to Newsom, "that could increase the total number of coronavirus cases in the country." Trump's tone was equal parts flippant and frustrated. It was the kind of offhand remark Newsom had learned to expect from a president who routinely hectored him about why California did not do a better job raking its forests to clear out flammable debris, an almost comically reductive view of the state's complicated forest management challenge. The president was not a student of policy, Newsom knew, and sometimes he just sort of said stuff. You had to wait him out and then ask for what you wanted, which in this case, Newsom told him, was federal cooperation with bringing the boat into dock and processing the passengers for medical treatment or quarantine. "Whatever you guys need," Trump said, according to Newsom's memory, "let's bring it in." On March 6th, Trump blurted out in public what he told Newsom on the phone. While visiting the headquarters of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, he was asked a question about the cruise liner and replied that he would leave the decision to others, but added, "I don't need to have the numbers double because of one ship." The media coverage was merciless. Here was the President of the United States, at the onset of a global pandemic, musing openly about massaging the infection stats by keeping a cruise ship at sea. For a governor like Newsom, there was no free political capital to be spent on outrage. The difficult reality of the situation was that a world-historic threat to public health was underway, and the man in the Oval Office was a shallow political provocateur. Donald Trump was not interested in negotiating the fine points of legislation or learning the details of his public health powers. Indeed, as the House and Senate swept a $2.2 trillion aid package, known as the CARES Act, into law, Trump was not even on speaking terms with the top Democrat in Congress, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. In conversations with Newsom, Trump typically called her "your friend Nancy," while the speaker would refer to "your friend Trump" in her own chats with the governor. The state, local, and federal officials tasked with managing the day-to-day response to the pandemic could choose to vent outrage about the lamentable realities of the Trump White House, or they could do their best to extract what they needed from the Trump administration by staying on the right side of Donald Trump. And the president, a notoriously vengeful man, made it more than apparent that he was keeping track of who treated him like a friend and who did not. Trump was watching, he told Newsom, for the reciprocity. He used to say that even privately, that it was one of his favorite words, Newsom says. It says everything and nothing at the same time. That transactional worldview defined Donald Trump's presidency, including his response to the coronavirus pandemic. A proudly divisive leader who saw the executive branch as an extension of his own personality, he had governed for 3 years as a factional president before the pandemic struck, a champion of his people and a scourge of the other side, however he chose to define those groups at any given moment. There had never been a pretense that Trump was a leader for all Americans, or that the White House saw no distinction between red states and blue states. He was the leader of his own coalition, a largely white, largely rural, largely working-class voting base that relished Trump's reactionary cultural politics, soldered to a largely white, largely urban, extremely wealthy donor base that valued his hostility to taxes and regulation. If other constituencies factored into Trump's week-to-week thinking as president, they only did so because he thought they might be politically useful for one reason or another. It was not the governing style of a president suited to pulling the country together in a crisis. But then, for three-quarters of his term, Trump had faced no crisis on the scale of the worst his immediate predecessors confronted. There had been no 9/11, no global economic collapse, no new foreign war, no truck bombs aimed at an American barracks in Beirut or a federal building in Oklahoma City. There had been episodes of horror, like the caging of migrant children on the southern border, but for the most part, those had been authored by the president and his aides, rather than inflicted on the country from above or abroad. When the pandemic struck, Trump did not have a plan for crushing it, or even a general theory of how to handle a public health crisis. After all, Trump had spent his whole term preparing to ask voters to give him another one based on a promise of continued peace and prosperity. For the first three-quarters of his presidency, unemployment had been way down. The stock market had been way up. Yes, Republican officials acknowledged, the president was thinly versed in the details of governing. Yes, he occasionally derided major American cities as vermin-infested hellholes and demonized people on the basis of their race or national origin. And, to be sure, his personality was problematic. Haley Barbour, the former Mississippi governor and Republican Party chairman, had taken to joking of Trump, "Narcissistic asshole syndrome is incurable after 70. But, Republicans insisted and mostly believed, many voters had decided to look past that and found Trump more palatable than the Democrats. Besides, their argument went, even if he was a factional leader, he was a factional leader who wound up creating wealth for everybody. The coronavirus pandemic shattered that argument. The unemployment rate soared to nearly 15% by April. Trading on the stock market had to be repeatedly paused due to steep plunges. Entire sectors of the economy, restaurants, hotels, airlines, movie theaters, effectively collapsed overnight. And at the outset of the 2020 general election, there was no end in sight. Donald Trump needed a new plan, a plan to win a difficult campaign. The president had anticipated that the 2020 race would be an easy one. He had dismissed many of his Democratic challengers in private conversations and lapped up rosy prognoses fed to him by solicitous advisors who went to great pains to keep bad news away from him. There was no apparatus in place to give Trump a tougher prognosis about his chances of winning re-election, let alone one shaped by an unpredictable public health crisis. Long before 2020, some Republican leaders, people outside the White House, had feared that Trump would face a challenge from a mainstream moderate Democrat who could win the election simply by making it a referendum on Trump's personality. The person many of them feared most was Joe Biden, the former vice president with an affinity for the blue-collar whites whose support Trump needed in overwhelming numbers. But Trump did not fear Biden. Indeed, at a dinner with Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, before the 2018 midterm elections, Trump belittled Biden as a joke, a weak old man, hardly someone to be feared. When Christie suggested Trump might be underestimating the grandfatherly Delawarean, the president scoffed at the idea. He told Christie he was more concerned about Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, since they would promise the voters huge new government benefits. That, Trump said, would be popular. Not that he would ever really admit to being concerned about any of his potential rivals. Flying to California on Air Force One in September of 2019, shortly after Elizabeth Warren had drawn a massive crowd to Manhattan's Washington Square Park, Trump boasted to the White House press corps that he could have commanded the same numbers in the heart of one of America's most liberal cities. "If I stood there, you'd have 20,000 people," he insisted. As Trump rambled on during the off-record session with reporters, his staff encouraged his bravado by applauding his stamina. Would Joe Biden do this? Trump asked. We've been going on 40 minutes, responded Stephanie Grisham, then the White House press secretary. Trump's court of sycophants appalled more clear-eyed Republicans. In 2019, the president summoned the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to the White House and instructed his aides to walk the Kentucky Republican through their presidential polling. They were forecasting a Trump romp from coast to coast, though there were still a few delicate strategic decisions for the campaign to resolve. Go get the hats, Trump told his assistant, Madeline Westerhout. She returned, to McConnell's visible dismay, with one hat emblazoned with the slogan, Make America Great Again, and another hat reading, Keep America Great. Which one, Trump wanted to know, should he go with? And should he put an exclamation point on the end? The Republican National Committee Chair, Ronna McDaniel, took a strong position on that last point. A former member of the party establishment who had gone by her full family name, Ronna Romney McDaniel, until her affiliation with the Romney clan became inconvenient, McDaniel curried favor with Trump by ridiculing another humble dynast. It reminds us of Jeb, she said, according to a person in the room, alluding to Jeb Bush's campaign sign punctuation. No exclamation point. Trump instantly agreed. McConnell remained impassive through the meeting. Telling Trump what he wanted to hear had become a way of life for an entire political party. Brian Jack, the White House political director, told Senate strategists not to share their swing state polling information with Trump lest he react badly to the numbers. When Republicans approached the White House early in 2020 to express concern that Trump could be vulnerable in Georgia, a once red state in the midst of a rapid demographic transformation, Jack responded, There is no way you can convince the president he will win Georgia by less than 10 points, let alone that he might lose. But of course, few people were trying to dissuade Trump from thinking that way. After a meeting at the White House in July 2020, McConnell expressed bewilderment to an aide about the stream of happy news Trump's advisors were feeding to him. It was one of the bleakest periods in the campaign for Trump, but no one could have known it from the cheerful prognoses presented by the president's political team. One Trump advisor in particular surprised McConnell, a fair-haired and sharp-featured man who offered only sunny forecasts to the president. McConnell wanted to know, who was that guy? Learning that it was Bill Stepien, Trump's new campaign manager, McConnell grumbled, He just tells Trump what he wants to hear. There was a horde of accomplices in this presidential-level coddling at every tier of the Republican Party, driven by an accurate conviction that Trump was a singularly popular figure on the right and that keeping his good favor was simply the cost of doing business. Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, stood out from the pack as perhaps the most ingratiating major figure in the GOP. Having failed in a previous bid for Speaker of the House, amid opposition from the right wing, McCarthy had no anchorage in his party's ideological waters. He was simply determined not to be outflanked on the MAGA wing. He had worked in politics nearly his entire adult life, first as a junior aide to his predecessor in Congress, then as a state legislator before winning his House seat in 2006. In an early meeting with National Party strategists during that campaign, McCarthy was upfront about the scale of his ambitions. He was running for Congress, McCarthy said, because he planned to be the Speaker of the House. Even as he rose, though, McCarthy retained the nose-against-the-glass style of a Bakersfield kid who wanted to make it big, always gazing longingly at the famous. In his case, that frequently meant quite literally showing off pictures of himself with movie stars. It also meant he was particularly vulnerable to the force field of political celebrity, first in Sacramento when Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor of California, and then when Donald Trump became president of the United States. McCarthy was always determined to be part of the in-crowd, and so it came as no surprise, but rather as a source of amusement to his fellow Republicans, when he sent Trump a jar of Starburst candy containing only the president's two favorite flavors. He was just as determined to present a menu of House candidates to the president that fit his tastes. He made a habit of briefing Trump on McCarthy's own favorite congressional recruits, making sure the president knew of the many nice things they had said about him in the past. On rare occasions when McCarthy wanted to enlist a candidate who had been critical of Trump, he would orchestrate displays of loyalty to appease the president. He instructed Carlos Jimenez, the mayor of Miami-Dade County and a former Trump critic, to tweet an expression of admiration for Trump in order to secure the support of the White House, and Jimenez had quickly obliged as he entered a crucial House race. In sessions with House and Senate strategists, Trump would veer back and forth between issuing edicts of intimidation and playing the class clown to a chortling audience. In meetings with McConnell and his advisors, the president would rail against Martha McSally, the appointed Arizona senator who is running for election in her own right. A former fighter pilot and survivor of sexual assault, McSally had denounced Trump after the 2016 publication of the Access Hollywood tape that showed the future president bragging about groping women. Like most Republicans, McSally had run back to Trump soon after, and she was campaigning in 2020 as a supporter of the White House. But Trump himself had not forgotten. "She's a horrible candidate," Trump would say. "Just terrible. No one likes her." McConnell would try to speed through the races where he knew Trump didn't like the leading Republican Senate candidates, often attempting to skip discussion of Maine entirely, where Susan Collins was running for re-election and had not endorsed Trump for a second term. But in several meetings, Trump could not resist weighing in with what he might call locker room talk about Collins' challenger, Sarah Gideon, the telegenic speaker of the Maine House of Representatives. "Sarah Gideon, very attractive. Very attractive," Trump said in one session, according to a person in the room. Then he added a joke at the First Lady's expense. "Not that I've looked at a woman that way in 5 years. 5 years at least." He and Melania Trump were married in 2005. But the president's threats were no joke. Republicans who had stepped out of line in more memorable ways usually found themselves defeated, driven into retirement, or pleading for forgiveness. As he prepared to run for re-election to the Senate in North Carolina in 2020, Tom Tillis recognized he had to make up with Trump for a severe infraction. In February 2019, he had written a column in the Washington Post criticizing the president's use of emergency powers to repurpose federal money for a wall on the Mexican border. Trump had not forgiven him, and voters at home had noticed. Tillis was consistently running behind Trump on the ballot in polling for both parties. "What am I supposed to do? Like, go in and just, like, grovel?" Tillis had asked an advisor. The answer had been, basically, yes. If Tillis, or any other politician, wanted to avoid the wrath of the country's most powerful Republican politician, or if they wanted the speedy cooperation of the White House on matters of substance, then they needed to show the president he could count on them to behave with lasting gratitude and extreme deference. It was the logic of a protection racket, more or less. You could be on Team Trump with some modest guarantee of political safety, or you could be against the president. That, in Donald Trump's mind, was the meaning of reciprocity. The president's operating style took on new significance with a deadly illness sweeping the country. Scores of governors were desperate to secure support and resources from the federal government, many of them Democrats who either had no relationship with Trump or a purely hostile one. As they scrambled to connect with the White House, they quickly ran into Newsom's calculus. Trump was most interested in helping people he got along with and regions of the country he saw as Trump country. By 2020, this had become predictable to those in the political arena, and it was easy to grow inured to his zero-sum outlook. But it represented a jarring break from civic tradition in a country where presidents usually put the full weight of the federal government behind communities in crisis. It did not matter to Bill Clinton after the Oklahoma City bombing that he had no chance to carry the state, any more than it mattered to George W. Bush on September 11, 2001, that New York would never vote for him. Trump was different. In 2020, the American president and his advisors had no compunction about inserting politics, personal grievances, and public relations gimmicks into urgent matters of state. As the coronavirus struck, governors found it difficult to secure the resources they needed urgently from the federal government. J.B. Pritzker, the Democratic governor of Illinois, spoke to Trump on March 23rd to plead with him to ramp up production of personal protective equipment. His state needed millions of masks, like many other governors. He wanted Trump to invoke the Defense Production Act, a Korean War-era law that allowed the federal government to mandate the manufacturing of materials required for national defense. Trying to connect with Trump on a personal level, Pritzker, a wealthy investor, told him, "Mr. President, I'm a businessman, and I don't like the government interfering with the commercial market, but right now we're dealing with chaos in the market for these goods. The federal government needs to act." The president heard him out, but when the call was over, Pritzker told an aide he was unsure he had gotten through to Trump at all. Even as some of the country's largest states were locking down virtually all public activity in the hope of saving their hospital systems from collapse, Trump declared on March 24th that he wanted the United States opened up and just raring to go by Easter Sunday, April 12th, a fantastical timeline that appealed to the president for reasons of bravado and branding. Then, on March 28th, Trump announced he was considering a drastic action to contain the coronavirus. He hoped to treat it, effectively, as a blue state illness, imposing a federal quarantine on the states of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Speaking to reporters at the White House, Trump explained he had been urged in that direction by a lot of the states that are infected but don't have a big problem. He mentioned the governor of Florida, the enthusiastically pro-Trump Republican Ron DeSantis, as someone he had spoken to that day. "They're having problems down in Florida," Trump said, "with heavily infected people arriving there from other states." The announcement sent a shockwave through the tri-state area, enraging the local Democratic authorities who were already overwhelmed with coronavirus cases and now feared that an unenforceable federal quarantine decree would be inflicted on their beleaguered administrations. Andrew Cuomo, at the time a national hero to Democrats for his showy pandemic briefings as governor of New York, publicly warned the measure would amount to a declaration of war. In New Jersey, Phil Murphy, a first-term governor, was scrambling to reach the incoming White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. A former leader of the hardline House Freedom Caucus who had insinuated himself into Trump's inner circle, Meadows had barely started on the job when the pandemic crashed into what would become the final year of the Trump administration. As the president was floating draconian movement restrictions on the country's largest population center, Meadows struggled to understand how such an order could even be carried out. Murphy's answer to him was simple. It could not. Ned Lamont, the governor of Connecticut, was pleading the same case with Meadows. A quarantine, he argued, would be a total disaster. "We've got, 500 roads going in and out, trains. You can't shut this down," he recalls saying. A few hours later, Lamont got a call from the president. He was backing off the quarantine idea. "We're just going to ask you to voluntarily limit traffic between your community, something like that," Trump told him, by Lamont's account. "I think it's the right thing to do," Lamont answered with bounteous gratitude. "I appreciate you doing this." The whole uproar followed a familiar pattern from the first 3 years of the Trump presidency. A hugely disruptive proposal introduced casually by the president, only to be quickly abandoned once predictable backlash and practical reality set in. But the stakes were higher now, and Trump's impulsive, highly political pronouncements had the potential to do damage on an entirely different scale. Like their colleague in California, Murphy and Lamont knew they could not afford to be cut off from the White House or to live in perpetual helpless fear of whatever Trump's next edict might be. And in the early days of the pandemic, the president was all over the map, one day endorsing lockdowns, another calling for a swift return to life as usual, sometimes seemingly dependent on whom he had last spoken to or what state he was focused on. Yet most governors did not have Newsom's easy cell phone relationship with the president. So Murphy chose to communicate with him by other means. He went on Fox News, tangling with Tucker Carlson for 15 minutes over New Jersey's crackdown on the pandemic and what Carlson called the suffering that this lockdown has caused. Without the lockdown, Murphy countered, the alternative would have been multiples of this. It was not a terribly rewarding interview, but the next morning, Murphy found it had had the desired effect. His phone rang, and it was the President of the United States. Trump had seen the interview, and he wanted Murphy to know he agreed with him. "The Fox guys," he said, "were bonkers about the pandemic. Hannity especially," Trump said. "That guy is obsessed with the Swedish model of looser public health restrictions," the president told Murphy. Listen, he's wrong, Trump said, according to Murphy's memory. The very next day, on April 17th, Trump showed why it was dangerous for governors to stray from his good side, even as he privately assured Murphy and Newsom that they could count on his support for their pandemic management strategies. He publicly spewed venom at another pair of Democrats who were taking essentially the same approach to the crisis. News media had begun to cover protesters in Michigan, Virginia, and Minnesota who were defying the governor's public health policies, and Trump was only too glad to amplify their angry complaints against the Democratic governors in all three states, Gretchen Whitmer, Ralph Northam, and Tim Walz. "Liberate Michigan," he thundered on Twitter. "Liberate Virginia and save your great Second Amendment. It is under siege. Liberate Minnesota." Walz, the Minnesota governor, experienced Trump's sudden attack as more than a social media broadside. "It brought armed people to my house," Walz says. "It put the security folks a little bit more on high alert." But he, too, calculated that he could not afford to escalate a conflict with Trump. In phone calls with the president, the governor says he tried to engage Trump on what exactly he was demanding from Minnesota. "I just really, really want to clarify," Walz told Trump. "What do we mean liberated from?" Trump talked past the question. Walz says, "I never got a response." Trump was not only burdening Democratic governors with his wildly careening approach to the pandemic. In private, Republican governors had begun holding conference calls where they shared their strategies for the pandemic away from the eyes and ears of White House aides. Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, a sober conservative who had served in Congress in the Clinton era, blames Trump to this day for sabotaging his own battle with the coronavirus at the state level. President Trump's comments, his rhetoric, and his almost flippant attitude in some contexts made it difficult for a governor like me to really push the seriousness of the medical emergency that we're in, Hutchinson says. One Republican governor drew Trump's personal ire when Brian Kemp, the Republican governor of Georgia, announced in mid-April that he was allowing businesses to reopen with certain masking requirements. The White House responded with fury. While Trump was generally impatient to return to life as usual, he and his aides disliked Kemp for political reasons and treated his pandemic management plans with a skepticism they did not apply to other Republicans. Kemp had been nominated for governor in 2018 thanks to Trump's personal support, a fact which the president never tired of reminding him. But Trump had long since soured on him, in part because Kemp declined to appoint a trusted Trump lieutenant in Congress, Doug Collins, to an open Senate seat. When Kemp's name came up from that point on, Trump would often repeat a sour refrain. "He's fucking weak, he's just a terrible governor, and I'm the guy who got him there," the president would say, according to one strategist who heard the rant repeatedly. As Kemp prepared to reopen his state, Trump conveyed his displeasure in a phone call, commanding the governor to rescind his reopening plans. Trump's pandemic response advisor, Dr. Deborah Birx, had been pushing hard internally against Georgia's plan, and for once, Trump seemed to be listening to her. "I got you elected," Trump reminded Kemp, according to one person present for the conversation. When the tense call was over, Trump instructed two aides, Brian Jack, the political director, and Kayleigh McEnany, the press secretary, to follow up with Kemp and figure this out. In a second call, the two aides pressed Kemp further, with McEnany taking the lead. A 32-year-old former cable TV pundit, McEnany told Kemp, the 56-year-old chief executive of a major American state, to withdraw his reopening order. Kemp protested, reminding McEnany that Trump himself had been urging governors to reopen. McEnany told Kemp that if he did not bend to Trump's preferences, then the president would come out against his plans in public. On April 22nd, the president made Kemp pay a price for his disobedience. "I disagree with him on what he is doing," Trump said at a press briefing. "I think it's too soon." On April 30th, Murphy was welcomed to a meeting in the Oval Office. There was no attempt to strong-arm him into hastening the end of lockdowns. After the meeting, Trump pulled the governor aside and led him into the old private dining room adjacent to the Oval. There, he showed the Democrat a precious document. "Did you see what happened in 2016? Trump asked him, presenting the Democrat with a copy of the electoral map from that year. When Murphy answered in the affirmative, the president probed, "Do you think I can win New Jersey?" Murphy, a gregarious former Goldman Sachs executive, paused to contemplate his options. Should he flatter the president further and say yes? Maybe, Murphy recalls thinking, he could goad Trump into burning money on the fool's errand of competing in Deep Blue, New Jersey. The stakes were too high. "You know what? I don't see it," he told the president. Trump did not mind. For whatever reason, perhaps Murphy's sizable personal fortune, the president had long ago decided this guy was one of the good ones. There would be no Liberate New Jersey tweets that day. Instead, Trump led Murphy and two of his aides into another adjoining room, one that the wide-eyed governor was shocked to find full of MAGA gear, hats, cufflinks, trays, the works. The display, Murphy says, looked like the gift shop at Disney. "They literally hand you a shopping bag," the governor recalls, "and you took anything you'd like." That same week, the American death toll from the coronavirus topped 60,000. As the spring progressed, Trump's interest in managing the pandemic only waned further. He stopped showing up for weekly calls with the nation's governors, leaving that job to his vice president, Mike Pence, who was managing the White House's coronavirus task force. The president's attention was on other matters, like how quickly he could resume holding large public events on the campaign trail. But the president's Cosa Nostra-adjacent operating style remained. Looking ahead, Trump was determined not to let the pandemic turn his nominating convention into a pale version of the spectacular, glitzy MAGA fest it deserved to be. The Republican convention was set to be in Charlotte, North Carolina, but the city's Democratic mayor and the state's Democratic governor had grave concerns about allowing the events to proceed. Roy Cooper, the governor, told the Republican National Committee in no uncertain terms that there could be no dense, unmasked indoor gathering in his state. On May 29th, the president called up Cooper directly to tell him that was a problem. Trump opened the call with a nakedly partisan taunt. "You'll be thrilled as a Democrat to know we're up to almost 270 judges. Can you believe it?" he began, referring to his latest slate of conservative nominations to the federal bench. Then he brought up the subject at hand. "I know that you're a little bit of a shutdown type," Trump told Cooper. "I understand both sides of that equation, as you can understand, but how are you doing toward the arena, toward the convention?" Cooper, a former small-town lawyer with the voice and demeanor of a likable high school principal, explained to Trump that the state was in phase two of its reopening, which meant there were still strict limitations on mass gatherings and commercial activity. "We've been talking to the RNC, and we've been talking about the fact that, you know, we know we've got to scale back with people inside, and we wanted to get options for what the RNC wanted," Cooper said. Cooper simply would not guarantee a 19,000-person indoor rally in his state's largest city in the middle of the summer. He did not understand why Trump could not grasp the urgent public health reasons for his hesitation. Didn't Trump want to protect his supporters who would flock to the arena in Charlotte? "Aren't you worried about them particularly?" Cooper asked. No, I'm not," Trump said. The president told Cooper they had both been right to support lockdowns early on, bragging that his administration had probably saved 2 million lives. But there came a point where enough was enough. "What people don't realize," the president explained, "it's a tiny percentage of 1% of the people that really get hit, and they're generally older people, and older people with a bad heart problem or diabetes or something. But it's really a tiny percentage." Trump was uninterested in a scaled-down event. It was essential, he said, to fill up the arena, otherwise we'll cancel the whole damn thing. "I've never had an empty seat from the day I came down the escalator," Trump said, adding, "I don't want to be sitting in a place that's, you know, 50% empty or more." Cooper thought he still had an opening to press his case, stroking the president's ego. "But you've been smart since this pandemic began," he said, "and you haven't been playing to large crowds since this pandemic began." "No, I haven't been playing to any crowds. No, I gave it up," Trump said, in a tone that conveyed that that was part of the problem. I think we'll start very soon because there are many arenas that will accept that. "You have other states where the numbers are lower," the president went on, joking about the Chinese province where the virus originated. "Hey, Roy, the Wuhan numbers are better." Trump stressed to Cooper he had plenty of other options for citing his convention. "There's a lot of Trump country out there," he said. The president closed the call by reminding Cooper that his administration had done much for North Carolina during the pandemic, and telling Cooper that he could expect to hear from the RNC to follow up on his convention requests. "We got you the ventilators, testing, we got you a lot, and that's okay," Trump said, making clear enough that it wasn't just okay, and he could use something for the effort. "We've been good to you. We gave you the National Guard, gave you a lot." The president's worldview, dividing the nation into Trump country and everybody else, pervaded the administration, and it afflicted even governors who tried hard to navigate Trump's towering ego. When Ned Lamont's blue state of Connecticut was competing to host a major pharmaceutical production facility against a site in Canada, the Democrat called up a number of senior Trump administration officials to ask for help. The facility would ultimately produce vaccines, Lamont argued. It should be in the United States. It was Peter Navarro, the volatile America First trade advisor, who gave Lamont the most direct signal on the administration's interest in the thorny details of international business competition. In a phone call, Lamont says, Navarro told him he was not interested in helping the governor navigate a negotiation against the fucking Canucks. Lamont, a patrician businessman whose great-grandfather had run J.P. Morgan, responded in a level deadpan. "Well, Mr. Navarro, you say it so well. Maybe you should send a message to the head of the pharmaceutical firm," he recalls saying. But Navarro did not want to help Connecticut. His prickly retort told Lamont everything he needed to know about the White House's view of the divided and suffering country. "I don't want to get involved with blue state politics," Navarro said, according to Lamont. On March 12th, a few days after President Trump complained to Gavin Newsom about bringing the Grand Prince's ship ashore, Elizabeth Warren got a phone call of her own. The progressive senator was standing in her dining room in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the dimming light of a late winter afternoon, when she found herself speaking with Joe Biden. The two had been declared rivals for nearly a year, battling for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination as two of the party's leading candidates. But they had been competitors for far longer than that. Their respectful but hard-fought rivalry dated back nearly two decades, to Warren's days as a bankruptcy law professor strenuously opposing Biden's quest to tighten the bankruptcy code on behalf of the credit card companies that made his home state their headquarters. Biden had won that old fight. His tough-on-debtors bill passed over Warren's impassioned objections in 2005, and only a week before this phone call, he had all but triumphed in the Democratic presidential primary. Warren had ended her campaign on March 5th, after Biden romped through the Super Tuesday states. Only Bernie Sanders remained as an increasingly token opponent to Biden's coronation. "I've decided I want to adopt your approach on bankruptcy," Biden told Warren, by her recollection. "Are you okay with that if I do that?" "Okay," Warren replied. "I'm over the moon." Biden went further, discoursing at some length to Warren about the importance of the bankruptcy code and what adopting Warren's approach would mean to families living on the economic margins of American society. Given the intensity of their past clashes on the subject, Biden's seemingly immovable commitment to his home state's credit card industry, it was a staggering reversal. A bit like Donald Trump calling up a liberal immigration activist and making the case for mass amnesty. When the call was over, Warren, a skeptical character by nature, was pleased but not quite sure what to make of it. "Sweetie," she called out to her husband, the Harvard law professor Bruce Mann, "guess who just called?" It was nice to hear Biden finally moving in her direction, Warren thought. But, of course, he was after her endorsement, and he had not exactly said what it would mean for him to take up her approach on bankruptcy. Maybe, only maybe, she thought, he would actually do something real on the issue. The next day, on March 13th, Warren was delighted to see in the news that Biden had endorsed her plan for bankruptcy reform during a virtual event with voters in Illinois. Biden said he hoped voters on the left would come to see there's a whole range of things we agree on. That moment, Warren says, was when you could hear the music starting to change from the Biden campaign. The Biden soundtrack, up to that point, had been a pretty bland assortment of tunes. The former vice president had stuck close to one message throughout the primary about restoring the country's soul and proving that Donald Trump was an aberration in the American presidency. Unlike his top rivals, Sanders and Warren, Biden had not electrified large parts of the Democratic coalition by promising a root and branch overhaul of the American economy. Indeed, in his early days as a presidential candidate, he had promised a room of wealthy donors that nothing would fundamentally change for them under a Biden presidency. But the cautious monotony of the Biden campaign was not driven only by a resistance to left-wing ideas. He had not campaigned as a fierce progressive, but neither had he waged his primary bid as an articulate centrist with an inventive set of ideas from the political middle. When he clashed with left-wing opponents during debates, Biden had typically questioned not the substance of their ideas, but their political viability. He had not, like Pete Buttigieg, delivered a detailed critique of the mechanics of socialized medicine, but had instead stressed that there was no path through Congress for the progressives' grandly expensive plan. Other moderate Democrats had introduced signature policy initiatives into the conversation. Cory Booker's proposal for baby bonds to wipe out childhood poverty, or Michael Bennett's Medicare X plan for an aggressive public health insurance option. The Biden campaign had put out white papers on policy, many of them focused on expanding the achievements of the Obama administration, or as his campaign dubbed it, the Obama-Biden administration. But when Biden was on the stump, he seldom talked about them in detail. Joe Biden's signature idea was defeating Donald Trump and bringing the country back together, and Democratic primary voters had rewarded him for it. In the space of a month, Biden had gone from back-to-back humiliations in Iowa and New Hampshire to dominating the Democratic pack in South Carolina and the Super Tuesday primaries. Some of it had been luck. Biden could not have planned on a split decision in Iowa between Sanders and Buttigieg, or on Warren cleanly decapitating the then-surging Bloomberg campaign on a Las Vegas debate stage, or on Sanders strangely choosing to spend the run-up to South Carolina litigating his views on the Castro regime in Cuba. But a lot of it had been the basic wisdom of Biden's campaign strategy. He and his advisors understood that the Democratic Party was obsessed with beating Trump, and that the party's leftward lurch had been overstated in the media. There was only one candidate in the race who was known to every Democrat in the country, liked by the bulk of them, especially African Americans, and seen overwhelmingly as a strong bet to beat Trump in the fall. That was Joe Biden. Sometimes politics is not all that complicated. Yet Biden's lightning victory in the Democratic race presented a new set of challenges, every one of them compounded by the onset of the pandemic. The disease had frozen the nation's public life, effectively snuffing out Sanders' ability to mount a drawn-out underdog candidacy for the nomination. But it had also complicated Biden's ability to reach out to the left and unify his own party. There could be no great unity rally with Sanders or Warren, no laying on of hands from the chiefs of the progressive movement to show the grassroots that Biden was now their guy. And Biden's spare policy agenda was now transparently unequal to the political moment. He could not simply campaign on beating Trump, buffing up the Affordable Care Act, and restoring American alliances around the world. The economy was a smoking crater, and mobile morgues were being deployed to manage the dead in major American cities. A return to normalcy campaign was no longer an option. In other words, Donald Trump wasn't the only presumptive nominee who needed a whole new approach to the race. Warren was not the only former Biden rival eager to see him drive an ambitious message in the general election. Cory Booker, the New Jersey senator who had pulled out of the primary fight in mid-January, urged Biden in March to embrace his status as a transitional figure in American politics, not in the sense of being a placid caretaker, but as someone who could heal the country and address some of its most urgent policy needs before passing the baton to others. During a car ride between Flint, Michigan and Detroit on the day he endorsed his one-time opponent, Booker urged Biden to present himself as a bridge to the next generation who could unify the country. That night, at Biden's final rally before the next day's primary, the former vice president would do just that, standing with Booker, Kamala Harris, and the state's governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and calling himself a bridge. But Booker also told Biden that being a transitional president did not have to mean going small on policy. If you just stood for the American public and said, I'm only going to do things that 70% of Americans want, that's what we need, is a sense that our president is fighting for all of us, Booker recalls telling Biden, offering mainstream gun control policy as an example. Locked down only days later at his Delaware home, a 6,800-square-foot lakefront estate, Biden set about mastering two parallel challenges, uniting the Democratic Party and mastering the complexities of the coronavirus pandemic. It was an almost entirely virtual exercise. Unlike Trump, Biden was in no mood to be cavalier about his personal safety in the pandemic. Then, 77, he was unambiguously part of a high-risk group. His brainstorming sessions on policy and his efforts at intra-party diplomacy took place over endless phone calls and Zoom sessions, including hours-long, near-daily sessions with a team of health and economics experts counseling him on the mechanics of pandemic response. For all his public avuncularity, Biden had developed a reputation over decades as a hard-driving, unforgiving boss who would surround himself with highly credentialed experts and then push their expertise to the point of exhaustion. Briefing the former vice president could become what some aides called a game of stump the staffer, a sustained effort by Biden to query and query and query and query until whatever unfortunate advisor he chose to test that day admitted he had asked something they could not answer. During his pandemic briefings, Biden did not just want to know how much money Congress was allocating for economic relief, but the exact paths that money would follow from the federal treasury into state-level agencies, and from there into the hands of businesses and consumers. He did not just want to know how many coronavirus cases there were and where, but how the federal government was distributing protective equipment, where it was getting it from, and how it was moving around the country. It was painstaking preparatory work, work that kept Biden out of public view and that did not necessarily bring him any closer to the imaginative vision of American recovery he now needed for the campaign. But Biden knew he needed that vision, and he said as much to another one of his former presidential rivals. One of the Biden campaign's short-lived ideas for putting its candidate back in public view without leaving his Wilmington property was launching a podcast hosted by Biden himself. And on May 4th, 2 months into lockdown, Biden taped an episode with Andrew Yang, the nonprofit executive who had run a quixotic campaign for the Democratic nomination as a champion of a universal basic income program that would pay out a chunk of cash to every American on a monthly basis. Before the recording began, according to Yang, Biden told him the country was at a decisive juncture. During the primary, Yang says, Biden had not been associated with big, bold, transformative change. The Biden who spoke with him that day struck a different tone. The country, Biden told Yang in private, needed a new deal, an update on the colossal program of public works, social welfare benefits, and business regulation introduced by Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression. It got me thinking, Yang says, about how Joe recognized what the country needed was something big and transformative. The question for Biden was what that something should be. The task of pulling together the Democratic coalition was just as complicated. Biden had won the nomination by marshaling a diverse alliance of voters on the center-left, from older black voters in the South to wealthy suburban whites in the North, and the vestiges of the Democratic white working class in the Midwest. All saw him as the best bet to beat Trump and to hold back the excesses of what they often called the Bernie wing. But if Biden's base represented a strong majority of the party, there was another 40% or so to be reckoned with, younger and more liberal voters, including younger people of color and Latino voters of all ages who had leaned toward Sanders in the final weeks of the primary. Biden did not know these voters as well, nor did he know many of their heroes in Congress. It was not that Biden did not have relationships with a younger generation of Democratic leaders. He did. He had campaigned hard for many of them in the 2018 midterm elections. draping his arm around Connor Lamb and comparing the young prosecutor to his own beloved deceased son, Beau, on the way to lifting Lamb to victory in a Pittsburgh-area House district. He had invited Lauren Underwood, a 32-year-old nurse who became the youngest black woman to serve in Congress after winning a tough Illinois race in 2018, to meet with him at his Washington office. There, he had counseled her on how to navigate a Congress that was inhospitable to young people, as it had been to him nearly a half century earlier. It was not that Biden had not thought about how to excite liberal Democrats in the general election. He had. In a meeting with Lisa Blunt Rochester, the House member from Delaware, before announcing his campaign, Biden had told her that he was strongly considering the idea of a female running mate. He seemed to know that his identity, his age, race, and gender meant he would need a very different kind of partner in the fall. But the ideological and cultural gulfs in the Democratic Party were persistent and serious, and there was no question on which side of them Biden and his inner circle resided. At one point in the general election, Mike Donilon, one of Biden's closest advisors, expressed bewilderment to a friend about the cultural attitudes he saw even among the youngest staff on the Biden campaign. "These kids," Donilon complained, "don't even want us putting Thomas Jefferson references in speeches." In what became a defining political choice of his general election candidacy, Biden tried to solve two problems at once. Under pressure to rally support on the left and to come up with a new set of ideas to match a moment of national crisis, he opted for an approach that was at once highly efficient and thoroughly unconventional. Flipping the traditional approach of hewing to the base in the primary and running toward the middle in the general election, Biden moved left after claiming the nomination. He decided he would adopt many of the policies of his progressive rivals to unite his party and flesh out his own, comparatively bare-bones governing plans. Exactly how far left he would move? Well, there would be a gradual process for figuring that out. That March call to Warren was only the beginning. In May, Biden impaneled a slate of policy task forces, bringing in centrists like Lamb to work alongside progressives, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, with a mandate to craft a more daring agenda that both broad wings of the party could embrace. If it ultimately became an agenda that conflicted with certain other Biden campaign themes, restoring national unity, reaching across the aisle, and working with Republicans, well, that was a tension he could work out later. To some people close to the Biden campaign, the months and months of introspection and policy negotiation, carried out in no small part from Biden's literal basement, felt like a dangerously passive posture at the outset of a campaign against a beast of an opponent. From their perspective, the Biden campaign staff seemed all too willing to leave Biden indoors, keeping him away from the cameras and boom mics that could offer him daily opportunities for verbal miscues. And Biden himself seemed to grow sensitive, as time went on, to the limits of his public profile. As he began to review campaign polling in preparation for selecting a vice presidential candidate, one consistent trend popped out of the numbers. People liked Biden, but their impressions of him were pretty vague. Biden asked one advisor with concern, "People don't really know that much about me, do they?" It was a grave worry for some of Biden's oldest advisors, and by the late spring, Ron Klain, Biden's once and future chief of staff, had taken to sending blunt, repetitive notes to the Biden campaign high command. He often typed in all capital letters, banging away again and again at the same impatient message: "Get him out of the basement. You are losing the election." Klain was wrong about that. As passive and invisible as Biden's campaign was on most days, he still had the upper hand by late spring over a president who was badly bungling not one, but two national crises. The murder of George Floyd on May 25th profoundly changed the character of the presidential race, thrusting issues of race, policing, and social justice to the heart of the political debate as in no other campaign since the Civil Rights era. A 46-year-old black man in Minneapolis, Floyd had been brutally killed by a police officer, Derek Chauvin, who knelt on his neck for 9 minutes in the course of arresting him on a trivial charge. The entire killing was captured on video, And as the nation watched Floyd lose his life, it reacted with volcanic moral indignation. Tens of millions of protesters filled the streets and parks and plazas of major cities and tiny towns, shattering pandemic-era restrictions on public gatherings and jolting Congress into a new set of talks on a federal police reform law. In Minneapolis, the site of the murder, police struggled to maintain control of the city as demonstrations turned violent and a police precinct building was set aflame. Biden even left his basement. In Delaware, Blunt Rochester saw a darkening mood in Wilmington and believed the moment demanded leadership from the state's favorite son. The congresswoman was one of only a few black women with clout in the Biden campaign, an operation dominated by the former vice president's overwhelmingly white circle of longtime advisors. Blunt Rochester bombarded those people with phone calls, warning that an ugly kind of upheaval could be at hand. Biden knew the potential consequences of that, she told them. He had lived through the 1968 riots in Wilmington and the long occupation of the city by National Guard troops afterward. Her message was simple, Blunt Rochester says. We've got to get out. On Sunday, May 31st, Biden visited an area of Wilmington that had been the site of large protests the previous night and was photographed kneeling and speaking to a young black man and his child there. We are a nation in pain right now, he tweeted, but we must not allow this pain to destroy us. President Trump was delivering a very different message. If the murder of George Floyd spurred Biden into a slightly more active mode of campaigning, it seemed to trigger something else entirely in Trump. The president had long since tired of managing, or even pretending to manage, a virus that was obstructing his re-election campaign, and he had stopped giving daily briefings on the pandemic after recommending off the cuff that Americans try injecting bleach or sunlight as a cure for the pathogen. One of his close allies, Jim Justice, the governor of West Virginia, had pleaded with the president to return to the briefing room and try speaking frankly to the country about the disease again. But Trump rebuffed the idea. The president was tired, it seemed, of feeling like the victim of forces beyond his control. He wanted to be in charge, and he wanted the public to know he was in charge. On June 1st, the day after Biden's outing to downtown Wilmington, Trump convened the nation's governors on a call. It was ostensibly one of the state executives' weekly gatherings to discuss the coronavirus with the administration, but when the governors logged on that Monday, it was immediately clear they were in for a different kind of meeting. Trump was on the call, joined by a team of advisors that included Bill Barr, the Attorney General, and Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense. Savaging the racial justice protesters around the country as terrorists, Trump urged the governors to exact retribution while demanding a swift return to public order. Esper, a button-down West Point graduate and former Raytheon executive, advised the governors that they should seek to dominate the battle space in their states. In the Rose Garden later that day, Trump threatened to deploy federal troops if the governors did not move swiftly enough. The executives were in shock. Up early at the governor's residence in Salem, Oregon, the Democratic governor, Kate Brown, called out to her husband in a nearby room, "You've got to hear what this guy is saying. You can't make this shit up," Brown remembers telling her husband. "You cannot believe that this is happening in the United States of America." At her state capitol office in Maine, Governor Janet Mills called out to a security agent, "You got to sit here and listen to this because I think the president of the United States is having a nervous breakdown or something, and it's scary," she recalls saying. The day would only grow more surreal. And the president put a camouflage-patterned exclamation point on it when he staged a cinematic photo op marching through Lafayette Square outside the White House and hoisted a borrowed Bible over his shoulder outside St. John's Church, where every president since Madison has worshipped. Marching behind him were Esper, Barr, Meadows, and, perhaps most remarkably, Mark Milley, clad in military fatigues. Coming after police cleared out protesters with tear gas and horses, the episode had the odor of an epaulette-wearing dictator asserting his authority, at least if the Cadillo had a taste for campy reality television. Many of the men involved in those back-to-back displays of strongman-style machismo quickly regretted it, and some said as much in public. Both Esper and Millie contemplated resigning, but decided to stay on the job lest their departure leave Trump's autocratic impulses even more unchecked. But in the moment, the whole production was an extraordinary act of menace by a sitting president and the cadre that surrounded him in government, and an unmistakable sign that the president saw his political interests being closely bound up with official threats of violence and displays of force. The next week, Trump invited Phil Murphy and his wife Tammy, the First Lady of New Jersey, to dinner at his golf club in Somerset County. The invitation itself presented a kind of test for the Democratic governor. Trump was in the midst of one of the most incendiary periods in his presidency, and he was asking a leading member of the opposition party to dine with him. But could a governor afford to say no, when the president was still in charge of the federal government's public health powers, along with billions of dollars and other resources that could help his state? On the patio at Bedminster, the Murphys found a very different Trump at dinner than the one who had marched across Lafayette Square. In New Jersey, the president was happily ensconced in his circle of yes-men, regaling the state's first couple with stories about Mike Tyson, the boxer, Trump said, had been convinced at one point that Trump was having an affair with Robin Givens, Tyson's wife at the time, and Tom Brady, the football star, Trump said, had not been the same after marrying Gisele Bündchen, who insisted on cooking him a painstakingly health-conscious diet. Far from a would-be dictator or even a ruthless partisan, Trump came off for much of the evening as a kind of Catskills comedian, ridiculing fellow Republican Marco Rubio for his robotic meltdown in a 2016 presidential primary debate, and even making light of his own uptight vice president. "Did you know," Trump asked the Murphys, "that Mike Pence won't even have dinner with a woman who isn't his wife?" This duality to Trump, the ugly demagogue and the snickering jokester, confounded Democrats and Republicans alike. How serious were the threats of a man who, in private, often seemed more Friars Club than Führer? The Murphys did not have much time to ponder this question at the time, as an upbeat Trump rambled about his re-election campaign. The president's daughter Ivanka and son-in-law were there to egg him on. Jared Kushner was delighted to show the Democratic governor the app they were using to organize a triumphant return to the campaign trail in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the following week. The crowd, Kushner said, was going to be out of this world. The stadium can accommodate 25,000, Trump boasted. The convention center nearby can take the rest. We'll do two stops. The only hitch, Trump said, was that the rally was scheduled the same day as something called Juneteenth. It was an occasion commemorating the enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of slavery, and while it was not yet a federal holiday, it had been celebrated for years in the black community. It was not a day that meant something to Donald Trump. "Can you imagine," Trump asked the Murphys, "changing the day of the rally in Oklahoma to accommodate these people? Have you ever heard of such a ridiculous thing?" It was a display of raw disdain for a population of Americans already in great pain after George Floyd's murder, and another sign that Donald Trump simply did not see himself as a president for everyone. At the end of the night, Trump showed Phil Murphy once again why reciprocity was important to him. The president summoned a press aide to show the New Jersey governor a tweet he had drafted endorsing an infrastructure project crucial to the state. Murphy had lobbied him at dinner to support a new rail bridge across the Hackensack River, and now Trump was prepared to send his guest home with a reward for his attendance. The Portal North Bridge now had his personal seal of approval. "You want to go out and do a press conference right now?" Trump asked. "The press is always here." Fortunately for Phil Murphy, the press was not there. There was no need to face the cameras with one of the most hated figures in his state. Trump's desire to restore his own sense of dominance and control, to show the electorate that he was not cowed or contained by some virus, drove him into a series of embarrassing conflicts and errors throughout the early summer. On the same June 1 call with governors when he threatened to deploy troops to their states, Trump berated Mills, the Maine governor, for asking him to avoid touring a medical facility in her state out of concern for security problems. He went ahead with the visit and attacked Mills as a dictator. The next day, Trump lashed out at another Democratic governor whom he saw as obstructing his campaign. On Twitter, he announced he was pulling the Republican convention out of Charlotte because Roy Cooper was still in shelter-in-place mode. Forging ahead with the planned Tulsa rally, Trump put local authorities there into a state of terror about the possibility of disease or public disorder. On the eve of the rally, the country got a sobering reminder of the pandemic's rampant spread. On June 18th, the confirmed American death toll from the disease surpassed 100,000. In Tulsa, the city's Republican mayor, G.T. Bynum, texted a colleague, "I just hope we can avoid a riot." There was no riot, nor was there the record-shattering crowd Kushner had promised. The campaign had not anticipated that fear of the coronavirus would depress turnout even among Trump supporters. Nor did it understand that in an unusual act of digital age political sabotage, countless Korean pop music fans had signed up for the rally to inflate the turnout number, only to leave much of the arena empty for the president's great return to the trail. It was an embarrassing flop. But as the summer proceeded, the president would only intensify his intimidation tactics with state and local leaders he saw as standing in his way. There was simply no distinction in his mind between his personal political urges and the powers of his office of state. In Chicago, Mayor Lori Lightfoot found herself harassed repeatedly by Trump after she issued an acid rebuke to the president for his violent threats against demonstrators. Her message to Trump, Lightfoot told reporters, starts with an F and ends with U. Trump had long made a habit of denigrating Chicago, but from that point on, Lightfoot says he seemed to make a point of savaging her and her city in especially harsh terms, language that would echo for days on Twitter and Fox News. Every time he did, the president stirred up ugly and dangerous forces in her city. I'd have people calling, "I'm going to come to City Hall and shoot her. I'm going to kill her. I hope she dies," Lightfoot says. You could see a spike every time he had said something about me personally. She was one of numerous public officials, governors, mayors, and members of Congress who began to step up their personal security arrangements during this period as a reckless president inflicted his own fury on a nation already seething with frustration and fear. In her case, Lightfoot says marked police cars took up positions in front and behind her house. Trump's tools for bullying extended beyond incitement and verbal abuse. In July, top officials in Trump's administration blurred the line between politics and government, deploying federal officers for a camera-ready crackdown on rioters in Portland, Oregon. Chad Wolf, the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, tweeted out photos of himself addressing camouflage-clad agents there in a scene that could have been staged for an action movie. Kate Brown, the governor, had reached out to Mike Pence to ask for his help calming the situation, and the vice president had interceded to encourage a withdrawal of federal agents. But while negotiations between state and federal authorities were still in progress, a senior official at the Department of Homeland Security warned Brown's chief of staff, Nick Blosser, that people close to the president were just fine with an ongoing clash in Portland. "Not everyone wants to de-escalate this," the official told Blosser. Trump's protection racket antics continued deep into the summer. To the shock of governors in both parties, the president even played political favorites with the emergency response money the federal government was handing out to distressed states. Since the start of the pandemic, Trump's administration had been picking up the full cost of state-level National Guard deployments in response to COVID. But in early August, Trump announced that the federal government would no longer be quite so generous. His administration would now only reimburse states for 75% of their National Guard expenses. Two states, however, would continue to get reimbursed at the 100% rate, Texas and Florida, the two biggest states with pro-Trump governors. Larry Hogan, the Republican governor of Maryland, says Trump spoke more or less openly about the preferential treatment he was giving a few chosen states. A frequent critic of Trump, who was chair of the National Governors Association at the time, Hogan had spent months lobbying the administration to keep up the flow of federal money into the National Guard in all 50 states. He was stunned when Trump extended the 100% reimbursement for two states only. Hogan recalls Trump saying that for the other 48 governors, everyone besides his allies Ron DeSantis of Florida and Greg Abbott of Texas, getting that extra money would require an extra conversation.
You have to call me and ask me nicely, Trump said, according to Hogan. Ned Lamont, the Connecticut governor, found out much closer to Election Day that Trump was not joking. After an early August storm that knocked out power around his state, Lamont petitioned the White House for an extra boost in federal emergency response funding. Lamont's phone rang in the evening as he was sipping his second glass of wine and awaiting a reply from the White House. It was the president. "There's something you want to ask me about FEMA?" Trump prompted him, according to Lamont's memory. "Yes," Lamont said, "there was." "Well," Trump said, in a not quite serious tone, "ask me nicely." By then, Lamont knew the drill. The president insisted on some display of fealty to make things move smoothly in his administration. Trump's words were not exactly a threat, but in the moment, Lamont says he felt like the Ukrainian president whom Trump had urged to do us a favor, though, in return for American aid. Still, Lamont had a job to do, and so he asked nicely. "We're in incredible distress," he recalls saying, "and it would mean a lot to the people that I represent every day if you could bring it upon yourself for 100% FEMA reimbursement." The magic tone worked.
"You got it," Trump replied.